Welcome back to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. With the financial crises of 2008 and 2009 trailing off into the distance, fundamental questions are surfacing about the unregulated market. Ellen Kennedy has long been making a case for the German economic model and why it has fared so well during the past few years, not just for the overall economy, but for the lives of workers and the general citizenry, too. Marcus Walker, economics editor at the Wall Street Journal Europe, sat down with Kennedy to find out more.
Professor Kennedy, you've come to Berlin to complete your research on a book that explores the different forms that a capitalist economy can take. Is that right?
That's close, but not exactly what I'm doing. What I'm really doing is trying to answer a question which is very problematic and yet concerns all of us today, and that's the question of whether the economy can be governed. Are we going to be in a long cycle of crises which cannot be mastered and which will continually produce political and social turmoil in the countries that are affected?
Now, this question has been around for a long, long time. What is different today?
I think what's different today is that we've seen the emergence of two very different kinds of markets. One is what I like to refer to as the real economy or the material economy, and the other is the economy of finance. My colleague at the University of Berlin here, Joseph Vogel, has referred to these two spheres as being virtual or real. So that what happens in that virtual sphere of finance has become more and more detached from the real economies that people live with and live in today. There's always been a certain part of this in the development of the modern economy. It's what the 19th century struggled with as Britain was industrializing so quickly. It is part of political thought and political theory in Europe and in America for more than 200 years. We start with Adam Smith and go right up to the present day. This has been a constant concern for all people who think politically.
Why come to Berlin to study this?
Because Germany's different. Because Germany has mastered that question better, I think, than the other developed economies, and certainly better than the United States and Great Britain in the 20th century. So we have to ask, well, why is this the case? Why have the Germans been able to do this better than we've been able to do it, for example? And there are a lot of different opinions about this, but I think there are really three major reasons that Germany has been better at this, mastering the economy, than we've been in the United States. The first one is that Germany had an historical opportunity in 1945, at the end of the Second World War, to rebuild an economy in a very different way, not only materially, because they'd lost so much of their material productivity, but they had an opportunity because they were able to write a new constitution based on the experiences of their country between the First World War and the end of the Second World War. And that new constitution contained a very specific commitment to an economy that would more equitably distribute benefits and burdens. This was called the social market economy. And that social market economy was able, and this is the third reason, it was able to be so successful because of the neutralization of Germany in the heart of Europe. Germany didn't have any military expenses after 1947-48. Germany was part of the American or the Soviet spheres, and in the American sphere, American might and American generosity, frankly, helped to build up the German economy in a way that took less than 10 years really to overtake our own productivity. If you look at the beginnings of the 1960s, you see that John F. Kennedy as president is really concerned that the Germans are going to outgrow us.
This is the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. You're listening to Marcus Walker of the Wall Street Journal Europe speak with Academy Fellow Ellen Kennedy about the German economy.
This term, social market economy, is probably one that few people outside Germany have ever heard. These days in the US, many people think that a large role for governments is some form of socialism, and maybe some people who draw more precise distinctions would say it's social democracy. So what is social market economy, and how is that different from socialism or social democracy?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's not socialism. That's the first thing that you have to be clear about. It was two very conservative politicians, Ludwig Erhard and Konrad Adenauer, who really were the moving forces, Erhard more than Adenauer, in creating a different legal and political framework for German business after the Second World War and at the beginning of the Federal Republic. So it's not socialism. And Americans in particular have a kind of allergic reaction to the word social and all of its permutations. And it's not primarily a government policy. Rather, it is a government attitude towards something that Adam Smith understood very clearly. Government has to provide the infrastructure, the legal and the material infrastructure for people who are in business, for people who trade and buy, truck and barter, as Adam Smith says, to do that efficiently, effectively, and with respect to for the liberty of individuals and for the well-being of their whole country. So it's a much larger thing than the ideas that we have of simply giving government subsidies to people who need them.
Don't all modern states try to provide an infrastructure and a framework of rules for business? What is distinctive about this idea of social market economy?
I think what's distinctive and what distinguishes it from other forms of modern capitalism, and those are planned economies such as we saw under the communist regimes, or strictly laissez-faire, free market, radical free market economies, the difference is that the social market economy maximizes the three values that all of those economic systems seek to pursue: efficiency, freedom, and equality. The highest degree of efficiency, freedom, and equality is realized, so the founders of the social market economy in Germany thought, it's realized by something which is neither totally planned nor totally free, but something in the middle.
What is different between Germany's way of running a market economy and, for example, the French way, which is based on this idea, or traditionally has been associated with this idea of dirigisme, which means that the government actually tries to take business decisions?
I think the difference is that the government in Germany does not try to take business decisions, but it does try to provide that foundation or framework in which companies can be efficient and equitable in their profits and the distribution of benefits. If you also look at the difference, the big difference, I think, between the United States, France, Great Britain, and Germany is that the role of what is called in Germany the Mittelstand, the family entrepreneurs, the family businesses, that's very great. In fact, 70% of German workers work for companies that are classic Mittelstand companies.
Now, this idea of the social market economy grew out of the writings of a group of economists who were based in Freiburg. Is that right?
That's correct. I think you can't draw an absolutely clear line from the Freiburg school to the social market economy, but certainly the ideas of the men who were working in Freiburg and also in German-speaking Europe elsewhere, notably in Vienna and in Austria more generally, the ideas of those men were very important in laying the foundations for a practical politician like Ludwig Erhard to make those ideas work. I mean, it's been described as a process of ideas into politics. Mm. And at the time, these were very new ideas. And in a way, you can say that our problem today is that we've sort of run out of new ideas. At least we've run out of good ideas about what to do in the course of managing or governing the economy in these nation states.
Let's talk a bit about these German economists, these thinkers who provided the intellectual support for what Erhard and Adenauer did when they were in government. Because I think outside Germany, this Freiburg school and the name for their school of thought, ordoliberalism, is barely known.
It's seldom discussed in England or in America. It is frequently discussed, but frequently misunderstood. in the German-speaking areas of Europe, and it's discussed, invoked, and mentioned in much of the European Union literature.
So what is ordoliberalism?
Ordoliberalism is a political and economic philosophy that believes we can govern the economy, and we can do so in ways that avoid the extremities of laissez-faire capitalism, radically free markets on the one hand, and the domination of dictatorial command economies such as we see in the socialist and communist countries of the 20th century.
It's certainly true that a lot of these Mittelstand companies have a kind of paternalistic culture mm-hmm. that you once had in the past in the US, but that is perhaps very rare now, in that profit maximizing isn't the only goal for these companies. Of course, they want to make a profit, but they also seem to have a goal of giving something back to their region, of maintaining the living standards of their workers. As you say, it kind of seems quaint nowadays amid the turbo capitalism right. that has become the norm in other countries. Right. So how can this culture, this business culture, survive?
It's not an easy question to answer, but I think what we have to recognize is how successful the Germans, despite having this commitment, or maybe because they have this commitment to doing business on their own model, they've been very successful. It hasn't damaged their economy. On the contrary, it's made the economy stronger, many people would argue, and I'm one of those people who says it's made the economy stronger, and it's actually made Germany a stable political entity within Europe.
This business culture at the level of the firm is reinforced, is it not, by some national laws and institutions such as co-determination. At bigger companies, this is the idea that the workers have rights to sit on the board at companies of a certain size or of a certain legal form.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. But I wouldn't put too much emphasis on that, frankly. I think that's been important in modifying the kind of class conflict model that has been the horror, really, of modern capitalism from the 19th century onward. The more important thing, I think, is that the owners of these businesses appear to recognize that they can do well by doing good. That is to say, they can pursue their own interest and still achieve values which are cohesive values, which build social confidence in not only the country, the individual, but the place of work. And those are all advantages of this kind of organization.
Now, the German economic model didn't always look as impressive as it appears right now right. to the outside observers. At yeah. the moment, there's a lot of interest in how Germany is running its economy, how it managed to come through the Great Recession pretty much right. unscathed, and with a lower unemployment rate at the end than it mm-hmm. had before the crisis.
Sure.
But if you think back a decade or mm-hmm. even 5 years, yeah. Germany was being described as the sick man of Europe.
Right.
It had a 12% unemployment rate. It had stagnation. There was hardly any growth. It was being written off, and people were saying Germany has to copy the U.S., essentially, and adopt U.S.
Right.
economic culture. Was that a complete misperception, or is it rather, was there something wrong with the way the German model had developed at the time?
I don't think it's a complete misperception, but I think that we have to recognize that the model of the social market economy has been reformed repeatedly, and it's been reformed in very dramatic ways since about 1982, when you could really see under the government of Helmut Schmidt the breakdown, the near breakdown, of that model of full employment, generous benefits, good infrastructure, constantly growing profits. You could see that model was going to have to be reformed for reasons that are internal and external to the Germans' own economy. But I think what's happened is that they've been able to do that. They've been able to liberalize, in some ways, their economy, to get it out from under a lot of the very great expenses that companies were bearing for the social programs that the government provides. They've been able to do that, but they've still been able to maintain a commitment to the quality of life within Germany that depends on companies participating in wanting that quality of life, recognizing that quality of life is in their own interests. not against their own interests. That's my take on it.
You're listening to the Berlin Journal. We're talking with political scientist Ellen Kennedy.
I think to people on the left, the social market economy means, yes, a capitalist economy, but also a big social safety net with a lot of welfare programs.
Right.
And to people on the right, it's more about a state as a kind of a strong referee in the marketplace, but not so much in the way of social welfare.
Well, I think that's a good description of the constant tension in German political economy throughout the 20th century. And if you say that it's changed from the early 50s to the present, one of the big things that changed was, of course, the reunification of Germany and the incorporation of East Germans with expectations that were very different from West Germans. I mean, they more than two generations had grown up under a socialized system, under a communist system. And they came into the reunified Germany with certain demands. So the political structure of Germany changed in that period, has changed in that period since the Second World War. I think that accounts for some of the changes which certain people, and I would be one of them, I'm certainly skeptical of merely subsidizing individuals or firms. The notion that the state has to be a strong but neutral referee is an old liberal image. You know, this is something which you can find constant in the thread of liberal thinking, which we call today conservatism. But the alternative to the state not being that strong neutral referee is twofold. Either it becomes the dominant and the game interfering referee, or it becomes what I think unfortunately has happened in the United States, the object of interests which ultimately control its ability to govern the economy. You know, I'll cite as someone or something that supports this, our Financial Crisis Committee report, which just came out in the United States in December, in which the members of that commission point very specifically to the involvement of lobbies and lobbyists for the big banks and the institutions that were too big to fail in the drafting and execution of legislation. So we have to be careful to go on the moderate path between a government that's overbearing and tells us what we should want, what we should do, and a government that is really too weak to act on behalf of the whole, to act on behalf of all of its people.
This is Marcus Walker from the Wall Street Journal for the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin.
You've been listening to an interview with Ellen Kennedy on the Berlin Journal. Coming up, novelist Rivka Galchen.
Hi, I'm Patrick Jaron Watsonanen. NPR Music is now leading an ongoing conversation about jazz for both avid fans and curious listeners. It's called A Blog Supreme. Here you'll find news, interviews, and recommendations of all kinds of jazz. We help start the discussion, and we want you to join in. Discover more at npr.org/blogsupreme.
Welcome back to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill. The award-winning novel Atmospheric Disturbances, published in 2008, describes a man who one day comes to believe that the woman who walks into his house is no longer his wife. Author Rivka Galchin, perhaps without surprise, studied both medicine and fiction writing, and her work in progress delves into some further complications of self-deception. She sits down with literary critic for Vogue magazine Megan O'Grady to discuss this new work and the finer shades of psychiatric trickery.
So, you studied medicine before you turned to writing, and I know that there are a number of very famous writers in history who have done the same thing, like Chekhov and Bulgakov, and I think Somerset Maugham. But it's pretty unusual, I think, for a writer of our generation. And how did you go from one to the other?
It was definitely sort of a handy mistake. I sort of probably never should have gone to medical school, and I always like to stick to any bad plan I make, so I just stuck it out. And it ended up being educational in ways besides medicine, which was really good for my writing, I think. But unlike a lot of the other kind of physician writers, I like need to sleep a lot more than them, and I just do the writing.
And you went kind of straight from getting an MD to an MFA, or how did that...
Yeah, I never left Degreeville.
But in your novel, the main character, Leo Liebenstein, is a psychiatrist, and you studied psychiatry, right?
Mm-hmm.
So did this character come from one of your experiences in medical school?
Definitely the language. His language came from that sort of special inside the walls of the hospital vocabulary, which is just beautiful. I mean, there's a lot of medical terms that accidentally sort of accidental poetry. It's sort of like when someone speaks a foreign language and they say everything sounds sort of cute somehow. Medical language does that a lot. Although I would say my character, I made him a psychiatrist. He's not based on anyone. He's not a very nice guy, so it probably wouldn't have been very nice to base him on somebody. I did base him on sort of the aggregate of people who sort of take a lot of comfort in their knowledge and sort of use their knowledge as a way to be sure they don't have to find out anything else.
Well, Leo, we should say he's one day is convinced that his wife has been replaced by an imposter, that she's missing and there's a substitute that is living in his house. But he's someone who's clearly thought a lot about the limits of human perception as a psychiatrist, and yet his own perception is clearly pretty limited, but he's not very self-aware. That must have been a lot of fun to explore.
Yeah, because it was sort of a really fun geometry. I definitely wanted him to be someone who had kind of all the tools and exposure to doubt himself, so that it would require a lot more work for him to sort of give credence to his perceptions, because I sort of think that work of lying to yourself is really interesting work. It's a creative job. It's a sort of really demanding creative jobs to be able to weave something that can deceive yourself, I guess.
I know that he has a pretty low view of psychoanalysis, but I wondered if there were psychiatrists that you had run across who you felt had pretty skewed perceptions of reality.
Well, I mean, the joke that they're all crazy is of course, somewhat true. But I don't know if it's, more true than for anyone else. I have a friend and she always says, everyone suffers from a very rare mental disorder of which they're the only victim. You know, just in a sense, everyone's off. They're just off in their own way. And so it's definitely a lot of that.
He talks about the consensus view of reality. And this is something that one of his patients, Harvey, suffers from a conflict about. In other words, Harvey's delusional, right? He fantasizes that he is on a secret mission from the Royal Meteorological Society. And at some point, Leo kind of crosses the patient-doctor barrier and gets very involved in Harvey's fantasy himself. In a way, that's also something that a relationship or that a marriage is dependent upon, is a consensus view of reality.
Yeah, I mean, I think writing is always a habit of stealing from enough places that it won't be called stealing. It wasn't something I was explicitly thinking about, but one thing people point out about Don Quixote that sort of gets missed in the way that he's kind of talked about in popular culture is that he's very cruel. Because he has this sort of, because he is differing from the consensus view of reality, He actually only wins about half of his battles. He ends up being cruel to himself in the sense that he's getting beat up all the time. He ends up being pretty cruel to his friend Sancho Panza because he gets him in a lot of trouble. And he sort of pretty bad things happen to a lot of the people that he intervenes to save. And yet by the end of the book, when he sort of forsakes his view of the world and says, I was wrong about everything, you know, you're sort of already converted and you feel really sad that he's forsaken his view of the world. And my character, like on a much smaller scale, because, you know, that's like an epic mock epic, and I like just like a mock epic. And on a much smaller scale, in a sense, there's something romantic about Leo's devotion to the woman he married. It's somewhat romantic that he's so devoted to her and so in love with her that even that he can't fall for anyone else, even if it happens to be the same person, you know, yet it's also very cruel. It's cruel in the most old-fashioned way of just not seeing the person who's in front of you. And so, in a sense, the wife, although she like barely gets to speak, my hope is that sort of, in a sense, her predicament comes out, that she's, you know, suddenly someone's telling her that she's sort of betrayed them simply by like developing and changing and being herself. And the person who's saying this is the most important part of her world.
This is the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. You're listening to Megan O'Grady talk with novelist Rivka Galchen.
There's another emotional register in the book, which is that you included your father actually as a kind of character in the novel. Can you tell me how that came about?
Yeah, I mean, at first it was just, you know, first novel entertainment. You know, you're writing your first novel, so the only audience is you. I just somehow, like when I was working on the book, as soon as I stuck his name in there, it amused me and it made me happy. And also my dad has like a weird name, like Zvi Galchen, which I always thought has like a little bit of a talisman quality to it. You know, over time, like, of course, you realize your brain is always like seeing patterns that the other part of your brain hasn't bothered to notice. Because in a sense, you know, my main character, Leo, has lost, you know, the most important person in his life. I mean, and at least that's his experience, that he's lost his wife. And, you know, and I like lost my, you know, father 15 years ago. And so in a sense, like I'm sort of pursuing that ghost and he's pursuing a different ghost, which I think just helped me emotionally connect to my character. And then also it ended up being the kind of thing like I was young enough when my father died that I was still sort of making the mistake that kids make about their parents, that their parents are very powerful, you know, that they can keep them safe or this and that. I mean, not hugely, but so there was also kind of something just fun. I was just entertaining myself about having my characters mistake my dad for someone powerful who can kind of, you know, solve the world and this and that. And so, in a sense, kind of reiterate that mistake somehow interests me to have that resonance.
And in the book, he's a meteorologist. I presume that's true.
Yes. So it's a meteorologist. And I use a couple of his papers. I mean, his personality doesn't come into the book in the sense that he's mostly imagined by these other people. But it was really nice to bring in his name.
And you also use some of the meteorological effects as these kind of beautiful metaphors, like the Doppler effect. And Leo coins the term the Doppler-ganger effect.
Yeah, it's always fun, I guess, to like have your character sort of co-opt an area of knowledge that they don't really know, and so then they're like always revealing more about themselves and like all the ways that they skew it, you know. Then you learn about the actual thing, so it sets up like a nice, easy, like automatic irony, like an automatic gap between sort of what the audience sees and what, you know, the character knows. So it's sort of instant irony, so it's nice.
And Leo's wife is Argentinian, and I'm presuming you must have spent some time in South America because a lot of the book is set there.
Yeah, I have spent a good amount of time in South America because that also is like my own little joke to myself in some way, because I thought my character is just so hostile towards psychoanalysis and such a performance of certain ideas of psychoanalysis. Like he sort of seems to perform the truth of a lot of kind of psychoanalytic thought. And then I thought, like, you know, Argentina has more psychoanalysts per capita than anywhere else, and it's just like the, I mean, they're they have like a Villa Freud. They just, I mean, there's, you know, they're sort of over the top in the other direction. So I thought, well, you know, my character should, in a sense, travel south, right? Like, you should go south, you should go, which is like metaphorically always like described as the unconscious. And I did need him to be in a landscape that was sufficiently foreign to him that, again, it left you basically finding out about him, because he doesn't have a lot of insight into the space he's in. So he's sort of, even more than he was before, in a situation where, like, everywhere he turns, he's just seeing himself. His own misperceptions come back a lot faster.
Let's maybe talk a little bit about what you're working on now here at the Academy. Well, maybe you can tell us if if Berlin factors into the book in a way, in any way that similarly to the way Argentina factored into the last novel.
Well, it kind of only factors in connections sort of between Germany and like America, cowboy and Indian culture, because the novel is in large part set in Oklahoma, which I've been reading like Carl May novels while I'm here. Carl May, the German, you know, 19th century writer who just like wrote all these sort of cowboy and Indian stories, even though he never went there. So it's just sort of in the kind of imagined connection. And I definitely have to change the title, but my working title is stolen from the end of Kafka's America, where Carl walks for like 10 minutes and gets from the East Coast to Oklahoma and tries out for the Nature Theater of Oklahoma, it's called. And it's a theater troupe where everyone gets a part, and the part they get is to play themselves. And it's sort of this weirdly happy ending. Weird because there's never happy endings in books, and there's certainly never happy endings in Kafka. I mean, obviously not straightforwardly happy, but those are the only sort of cheap German connections.
Thank you for joining us on the Berlin Journal.
Thank you for having me.
This is Megan O'Grady for the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin.
You've been listening to an interview with novelist Rivka Galchen. After the break, art critic Hal Foster talks with Isabella Graw about the Berlin art scene and the languishing state of art criticism.
I'm David Green, one of NPR's foreign correspondents, and I have no idea where I'll end up on a given day. Could be the wilds of Siberia, could be an intense war zone, maybe it's interviewing a Russian rock star. Wherever it is, I know I'll meet people. I'll listen and try to understand what they're going through and what they dream about. Learning about people, seeing the unexpected, it's what I love about my job. And wherever I land tomorrow, I want you with me every step of the way. This is NPR.
We're back with the Berlin Journal. Acclaimed art critic Hal Foster is at work on a project that reinvestigates some strategies of the modernist avant-garde that have often been overlooked. In Pathetic, Brutal, and Banal, he sat down with the editor of the art magazine Texte zur Kunst, Isabella Graw, to talk about modernist practice, Berlin's art scene, and the troubled state of art criticism.
So I first wanted to ask you what you are working on while staying in Berlin.
Well, I have a project, a book project, that involves three related strategies in 20th century art, the pathetic, the brutal, and the banal. And they're connected, at least in my mind, as strategies of survival. I'm interested in moments, states of emergency, when things go to hell, and what artists do in these crises. And so the first part on the pathetic focuses on Dada during World War I and right after. The second, which focuses on the brutal, is concerned with artists in the aftermath of World War II. So that's about the fascination with things that are brew, as in absolutely raw, things that are brutal, as in brutalist art and architecture. And then I throw in this fascination with the animal or the creaturely in Cobra, among Cobra artists from Copenhagen, Brussels, and Amsterdam. Again, right after the war, but in this case, World War II, and then finally the Banal is an epoch that continues, I think, but emerges for me with pop. And there I've thought for a long time about this strange convergence between the infamous thesis of Hannah Arendt about the banality of evil and the fact that banal is the term that comes up again and again in the reception of pop. And it seems to capture a concern about the loss of depth, mm-hmm. profundity, you know, moral profundity, aesthetic depth that happens at this moment.
What drives you toward crisis moments?
For me, the emergency is less to do with the market than with governmentality, with governments. This is a moment when law is suspended. So I think there are all kinds of artists in the present who seem to act out of a state of emergency, maybe act it out too. And I see this as active in artists like Thomas Hirshhorn or Isaac Enskin, others too. So certainly contemporary art bears on this project. People like you and me, we tend to think about the avant-garde historically in a couple of different ways. We tend to think of them as transgressive, in which case there's a law that's in place that needs to be transgressed, or legislative, as though there were no law, and so there has to be a proposal for a new order. I mean, an example of the first would be surrealism. An example of the second would be the Russian avant-gardes, like constructivism. But I think so many other avant-gardes exist in neither a transgressive mode or a legislative mode that they're in a situation in which the codes are not clear.
I reread the introduction to your book, The Return of the Real, and it was interesting to notice how pessimistic you were about criticism at the time. This was in 96, I think. And you spoke about, you know, how there is little criticism and how it is absorbed by market factors, promotion. And, you know, and since that time, of course, a lot has happened, and there have been a lot of different ways of saying goodbye to criticism and deploring its supposed weakness. And I just wanted to ask you what your impression is as far as the power of criticism is concerned, so to speak, when you are in Berlin. Is there still something like a public sphere? Do you feel that criticism residually at least exists in Germany in contrast to New York? How would you assess that situation?
I mean, I was desperate about criticism 15 years ago. I mean, that book, Return of the Real, is 15 years old. I'm even more so now, if that can be possible. On the other hand, none of the options, the celebration of beauty, the delight in affect, those are two options that are given to us now in a post-critical moment, interest me at all. And I always think that there are critical moments, I mean, moments that are not necessarily expected. I think the rote positions of criticality are precisely not critical anymore. But I haven't given up all hope. I also think that it is different here. I mean, one obvious difference between Berlin and New York, at least in terms of our worlds, is that this one is not as commercial, and so there's a space for discussion. I mean, there's a discursive environment here that doesn't exist in the same way in New York. That said, I think that there are other ways to be an artist or other ways to be a critic here than there are in New York. I often wonder if the buzz about Berlin is just that. I'm not totally convinced that this is a scene that is driven by an innate set of problems, questions, and answers. I mean, the people I know that are active here as artists and critics come from elsewhere. I mean, sometimes elsewhere in Germany. That's mm-hmm. true in New York, too. Mm-hmm. People come there, Americans do, to have the intensity of the city. But elsewhere, too. I mean, Berlin seems to be more of a hub. and discussions happen at this hub, but often the work goes elsewhere, whether it's a text in a magazine or a show.
Yeah, it's a kind of Berlin is like a cheap labor possibility that is outsourced. And, you know, everybody who is here can imagine that we live in this kind of bohemian freestyle zone. But at the end of the day, the work is produced for these different international art fairs. Cheaply, though, because the rents are cheaper and so on. So there is everything that happens here is totally connected to the kind of global corporate art market. But you get you can imagine that you're not part of it when you sit in a cafe in Mitte, because it's not so visible, right? Gagosian is not there and so on. Right. So you can kind of project upon Berlin as this kind of bohemian fantasy land. But at the end of the day, it's totally part of this global art market.
But maybe in the fantasy, there is space too. I mean, I don't mean to be as cynical as I sound about Berlin. I mean, what do I know? I'm just here for a few months.
You're listening to Isabella Graw talking with art critic Hal Foster, a Spring Fellow at the American Academy in Berlin.
I think there are moments in different cities in the history of the avant-garde where there was a specificity to the place that helped to produce the work. And I'm not sure that I see it here. The way I think you can make the claim that whether it was Warhol in the 60s in New York or all kinds of different process, site-specific, institution critical work in New York in the 1970s, there was a particularity to the moment that
Place. And if you come to New York still today, you can immediately identify a formation of artists and critics that are discussing something and that you are interested in. And it's very difficult to identify these formations here because the whole scene is very, you know, segmented. It's difficult to understand or to get a grasp of what is actually at stake and what do people discuss, because if they discuss things, they do it in a bar in Wedding that you don't even know about. Yeah, and then there's another bar in Kreuzberg and another scene, and these scenes don't know about each other either. So it's very kind of, they're...
Well, that's, I mean, I think that's actually where I might disagree with you a little bit, in the sense that I don't think that there's a global situation that we all feed from our little sites of production. I think that talk of globalization, at least cultural terms, is overstated. I think it's actually a neo-feudal moment of all kinds of different little centers that are connected, and maybe the analogy there would be the internationalism of the church, but are really quite distinct, and maybe even distinct within each site too, where there are these different conversations, as you say, even Berlin. So I think there was this sort of rush to think the globality of everything in this last period of time, but that's not how I see it. I don't think that's how it's lived.
I think
there are people are networked, but these networks don't necessarily overlap much, and they don't extend very far.
Yes, and they coexist next to local specificities.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. But you know, when you just said that you're even more pessimistic about criticism than you were in '96, I must think that I'm not pessimistic at all as far as criticism is concerned, because I think during the boom times, it's true that criticism mattered little, at least in the kind of commercial art sphere, and no collector who would buy a Damien Hirst would go and read a review before buying and think it through, you know, because of what the author has written. So there was a kind of marginalization of criticism from this kind of commercial auction house sphere. I would agree with that. But on the other hand, you know, I think criticism is able not only to produce value, but also to raise objections. And I'm totally aware that if I raise an objection against an artist today, it won't have an immediate effect. But as soon as it's published, as soon as these kind of skeptical thoughts are published, there's doubt in the world. And it's my experience as a kind of editor of a magazine that does have an effect. People get nervous. The dealers don't like it. They kind of stop advertising. The argument is out there. And if it's a well-put argument, if it's thought through, you know, the whole notion that this artwork is so interesting might crumble because of criticism. So I do think criticism has, you know, especially art criticism, has power.
But how do you maintain a place apart? I mean, if you are friends with this or that important artist or esteemed figure, and the same thing with curators, how do you personally, in your own practice, stand apart? I mean, you just edited an issue of Texter Kunz with the provocative question, where does it come from, Immendorf, or where do you stand, comrade?
Colleague, yeah.
Colleague.
But oh. Comrade is good too.
Comrade is even more nostalgic. So how do you find a place to stand apart?
I think that, you know, first of all, if you also look at the history of criticism, most critics were friends with the objects of their evaluations. The only problem being that this was rarely mentioned. These kind of friendship dependencies were rarely addressed. I mean, you can go back to the Renaissance. I mean, even Alberti was friends with the artists that he wrote about. He actually said so in his treatise on painting. But so the first thing is, I think there needs to be more transparency as far as these kind of relations are concerned. And then I would say that criticism is by definition both associated and dissociated.
Do you think that in Germany, because of the tradition of newspapers, of the essay within newspapers, and support for magazines and reviews like yours, that enables that kind of space of objection? In the United States, we all fled to the academy, and you have an academic position too, but the academy has its own contradictions. But do you think that there is a, you know, public critical sphere in Germany that's historically invested and is historically treasured even, that's continued?
I think it's shrinking. I mean, if you look at the newspapers and the feuilleton sections, you will realize if you compare the situation to, say, the 1980s, you will realize immediately that there's much less space for reviews, especially reviews of exhibition and literature.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what has taken the place of these reviews are like personality, style, interviews, and so on. So this space is shrinking. And Texter zur Kunst, you know, was founded in 1990, and this was a situation, an exceptional one, where many people like myself had like interest in theory and academia, and were also kind of positioning themselves in a kind of pop cultural environment, and were doing like more journalistic work. Nowadays, this is rarely possible because people have to decide either to go to academia and to really focus on the academic work because there's much more pressure now, or they go into journalism. And if they are a journalist, you know, they don't have the time to read, you know, the newest book of Giorgio Agamben. So they will be less and less kind of invested in theory, and their writing will become lighter and lighter. And this is the kind of, highly polarized situation that I'm facing now also as an editor, where I have either people who are completely immersed in academia and highly specialized, or lightweight journalism. So right. I guess it's a bit similar than in America too, no?
I think that divide has already happened, and you can almost date the decline and death of the New York intellectual, as that beast used to be called. That happened a while ago.
So many people have argued that because of artists having like taken up the function of criticism, criticism has become obsolete.
In terms of the future of criticism, I think that there is charisma in the critic too, the great critic. And for me, Baudelaire is one, Benjamin is another. I mean, these are obvious examples, but less obvious would be a person who just died at the age of 90, Leo Steinberg. There's a charisma to critical thinking that is also creative. And I think as long as there are such critics, there will always be more critics. Look, you become a critic often for the same reason that you become an artist, because you are not happy with the status quo. You don't want to do what your parents did. You don't even want to do what your friends do. You want to opt out. You imagine that there's another space. You seek an alternative. And there will always be, in a culture of affirmation, the desire to be critical.
You've been listening to an interview with art critic Hal Foster. We also heard interviews today with political scientist Ellen Kennedy, interviewed by Marcus Walker of the Wall Street Journal Europe, and novelist Rivka Galchin, interviewed by Megan O'Grady of Vogue magazine. The Berlin Journal is a production of the American Academy in Berlin and National Public Radio. For more on the American Academy in Berlin, please visit www.americanacademy.de, and for more on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide, please visit our website, nprberlin.de. Our production team includes Ralph Martin in Berlin and Sarah Richards in Washington. I'm your host, RJ McGill. Thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal. We'll see you next time.